This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Okay, it's time to get going again, and our second reader of the evening should need no introduction, as he's a regular member here, has a story in Airship Shape and all this sort of stuff. So can we have a warm welcome, please, for Mr. Pete Sutton.
Thanks, Cheryl. So I'm going to do two pieces tonight. One from the work in progress, just to prove they exist, and a short story as well. So the one from the work in progress is very short, maybe about 3 minutes long, but it does need some setting up. So the book's set partly in the First Crusade, partly throughout the rest of history, and partly in the modern day. And during the First Crusade, there are seven Crusader knights that have joined together and have chosen to follow the seven heavenly virtues. They've each taken a virtue as their name, their knightly name. And this bit of the book is just after Antioch has fallen, and most of the Crusader army is in the area of Antioch trying to get food and things. And a small group of the Crusaders go off to a small city called Ma'ara, and this is what happens. The seven wait the call. Each has been shriven. Each has prepared how they can for the day. Raymond pays fervently. His stomach cramps. A knot of tension crawls up his back. His skin itches. The damn sand got everywhere. He was always irritable before a battle. He hated the waiting. He hated the fighting too. But at least he's good at that bit. He reflects that it's only his outward appearance that seems cool and collected. And this is why he's named Patience. It's not a fitting name. Not before battle. Especially not when there's no real plan. There are no siege engines. They're expected to run towards the city, climb over the debris into the killing ground, and up hastily made ladders. Seems the men in charge think that the city's defenders won't put up much of a fight. The seven are assigned to a squad in the second wave. Could be worse. Could be better. Means they'll be running over the corpses of the first wave. Each of the seven waits in his own way. Some pray. Some pace. Some rest. Raymond looks like he's resting, but his thoughts race. The commander asks them to be ready. It won't be long now. The men who are resting now stand. They get ready to run to the wall. It is no joke to run in this heat with the amount of armour they are wearing. The command is given. They start slowly but speed up to make the shelter of the ring of debris. Broken carts, furniture, doors, and even dead animals have been stacked haphazardly. Once they are at the barrier, they are at the outer limit of the range of arrows. Raymond looks up, and across to where the first wave has got to, a fraction of the men that set off have made the wall. He climbs the debris mechanically, ready for an arrow to strike at any moment. One lands next to him. It has gleaming white feathers. Glancing at it, he is surprised to see a sheep's head staring at him. On the other side, and now in range of the majority of archers, the steel rain of arrows comes thick and fast. He rushes forward. Past the man who's screaming, three arrows already sticking out of him. Raymond hopes another will take him quickly. It would be a mercy. The commanding noble pulls slightly ahead, and Raymond starts to pay attention to what's in front of him. The wall is topped by defenders, who pepper the crusaders. This is a shambles. The commander is hit. He goes down heavily, an arrow sticking out where his neck meets his shoulder. They reach the wall. Now there are not just arrows, but heavy stones to avoid as well. There aren't enough ladders. So Charity takes control. We must retreat. Raymond glances at him before having to jump aside to avoid a rock thrown from the top of the wall. Retreat? That's madness, surely. This is madness. Sir Charity sweeps his arm around, taking in the dead and dying, the lack of proper preparation, the better than expected defences. Sir Diligent, who is standing next to them, does not need to be given explicit orders. He fills his lungs and shouts, "Retreat! Retreat!" Raymond shakes his head. Time to run across the killing ground again, but this time with his back to the enemy. It is long minutes, sprinting with the skin on his back crawling all the way. The seven stand heaving and panting back at the safe distance. Sir Temperance is the first to get his breath back. Well, that was a fucking disaster.
Thank you.
the second one's quite different. It's a bit different for me as well. So I'm writing a collection of short stories based on the Counting Magpies song. One for sorrow, two for mirth, three for a wedding, four for a birth, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never to be told. And this one's five for silver. Dreamy, daydreamer, away with the fairies, head in the clouds. That's what all my school reports said. You'd think they were millstones, wouldn't you? Positively negative traits not desired by any employer. Well, Mrs. Fassett was different. She looked for children like me. Came and sought me out especially. Mrs. Fassett with Albert, Alfred and Algernon. Came to my school. Stood in front of the teachers at assembly, like a heron and three crows, and pointed at me. That one, Mrs. Fassett said. I heard her perfectly, with her finger at the end of a tweed-sheathed arm pointed unerringly at me. Are you sure? Mr. Garner, the headmaster, his head particularly glistening and shiny that day. No surprise we called him Slap. Yes, of course. I'm not used to being questioned. Make him ready for 4 p.m. At this, Mrs. Fassett took out a large pocket watch on a long silver chain, just like you see on the old films, for the new films about the old times. She took one more sweeping glance around the room, tutted, clicked her fingers at the owls, although I didn't know to call them that yet, and trooped out. Her heels clacked, their shoes squeaked, loud in the silence echoing in the large hall, but I could see lots of the other kids looking at me. It wouldn't be long before the whispering started. At 4 p.m. precisely, I stood outside the main gate, having been manhandled there by Mr. Humphreys, Hump the Grimp, the games master. By means of pushing, pulling, grunting and growling, he got me where he wanted me. Stay, he shouted, his bushy eyebrows marching towards his hairline, and as if thinking better of it, possibly because they get lost in the thick forest of hair, they shuffled back down to above his eyes. He scratched his bushy beard, glanced at his watch, lifted the whistle he wore around his neck to his lips. This was a nervous habit we all emulated in the most silly way possible when he wasn't looking. He grunted again, turned around, almost fell over me. Stay, he barked for a second time, before wandering off back towards the playing fields, seemingly job done. I sighed theatrically and looked from one end of the school building to the other. When I turned my eyes back to the driveway, I was surprised to see a small car, a battered Fiat Panda, which sat waiting for me, like a dejected puppy who is sure a walk is out of the question. Inside were Mrs. Fassett in the driver's seat, with a strange hat upon her head and leather driving gloves, and the owls sat in the back, sometimes shifting en masse one side to another, as the owl in the middle, I forget which one, they're so interchangeable, elbowed one or the other brother to try and get more room. Mrs. Fassett opened the passenger door and gestured me inside. As soon as I sat down and closed the door, the car leapt away. Mrs. Fassett stared ahead. Seatbelt, she barked. As I struggled with the seatbelt, as we were taking a long slow bend, neither slowly nor longly, Mrs. Fassett interrogated me. Name? Bentley, miss. Like the car? Yes, miss. Age? 13. How many dreams you have per night, Bentley? It's with an E, miss. Oh, yes, of course. Well, Bentley? I don't know. The car came skidding to a halt as the seatbelt clicked into place, and although I was thrown forward, the belt did its job admirably, and I didn't go straight through the windscreen. Gate! I belatedly realised it meant that I had to get out and open the gate. But when I got back in, the door had hardly closed when the car leapt off again. Don't know. You don't know what, miss? You don't know. You don't know what I don't know? I said, confused. You don't know the number of dreams you have at night. Oh, that, five? I don't know why I said five. It happened to be both the right number and the answer she was looking for. One of the owls said, five for silver. And when I turned round to look, they all grinned at me, eerily. Similar grins on their triplet faces, all with the same lank black hair and neat black suits. They may have been slightly older than me, but not by much. Miss, I know you don't like questions, miss, but no one's told me what this is about, and I'd quite appreciate it if you told me, miss. I got to the end of this little speech, and Mrs. Fassett took a long look at me, which is slightly alarming as the traffic flowed by on either side of us. Yes, well, you, my boy, have been chosen to assist me in a great matter. I am, and I say this with no false pride, the best biblionaut in this country. Ah, she said, raising her hand, index finger held aloft, to forestall my obvious question. And I have a grave, an onerous, an oath-bound duty to perform, for which I require the services of a dreamer. There's a faint coughing from the back of the car, and the able assistance of the etc., etc. The car swerved round the corner and came to a dead stop. We're here. Here seemed to be a plain corner shop with an olive-green exterior, shuttered with a faded awning, Facet & Co. neatly painted over the door, books for the discerning customer on the door itself. I climbed out after Mrs. Facet, who tossed her gloves and hat through the open door onto the seat. As the three owls clambered out, looking a little disapprovingly at me, etc., etc., I heard one of them mumble, I'm not sure which. Facet & Co., Mrs. Facet said, pointing first to the shop, then to herself, and finally to the owls. Shall we? One of the owls raised the shutter, and we walked inside. The inside of the shop was redolent of aged paper, as row upon row of leather-bound tomes lined all the available walls, spilled over onto all the available surfaces, and dripped onto the floor, forming big stalagmites. A rather large, fat, orange tomcat eyeballed me briefly, licked its lips, and then slumped back into slumber. We trooped through the outer shop, before going through a moth-eaten velvet coat and into a tiny kitchenette, where one of the owls lit the stove. Another filled a kettle, and a third washed up four cups. Mrs. Facet lifted a bone china teacup and saucer, with blue and red flowers upon it, which matched the teapot. Alfred picked up a world's best XXXX Alfred mug. I couldn't tell what the hidden word was below the permanent marker, but Alfred had been scrawled on underneath in a childish hand. Albert held the mug saying, "This is a round to it." We said that one day we'd get one of these. On the bottom, a little sticker saying Albert, one corner unstuck. Algernon picked up a plain white mug. Mrs. Facet took in my lost expression, my school uniform, and the satchel clasped to my chest, and asked, "Tea?" I nodded, which caused the three owls to go on a voyage of discovery for a fifth cup. Eventually, finding one that looked like a freebie from a chocolate company that they'd been using to keep the cat's cream in the fridge, which they then poured out into a saucer, which no sooner they put on the floor, the cat appeared, purring and lapping it up. So, our mission. You sleep, we travel into your dreams. Specifically, the ones about the ocean. There's a good chap, do the job, and we get out. I'm sorry, what? Dreams, ocean, job, end of. I looked at the three owls, they looked back, blank. Can you just go over that bit again? Mrs. Facet held up a finger whilst the kettle came to the boil. One of the owls filled the kettle. Another took out a pocket watch. The third picked the kettle up like a crystal ball and swilled it about counterclockwise. Meanwhile, the first returned with a spoon. And at a nod from the one with the watch, struck it sharply, which prompted the third to place it gently upon the table. Mrs. Facet poured tea in her own cup and then mine. The three owls poured for themselves, one after the other. Which bit? The bit where you explain what's going to happen. So all of it then? Well, yes. Let me use an analogy. Your brain is the car. Your dream of the ocean is the fuel. And we're going to drive to our destination using your fueled up brain. No, that's not any clearer. Fine. Silence. I couldn't stand it. Fine? Fine. Okay then. Show me where to sleep. Algernon, I knew it was him because he put down the white mug, gave me a rather sad smile and gestured for me to follow him. Bentley, I said as we walked up the narrow stairs, which were covered with yellow wallpaper. I know, he whispered, walking slowly up in front of me, his hand rubbing against the wallpaper, which was shiny around around hand height. No, I mean, my name's Bentley, what's yours? He turned his head and his sad eyes looked at me. Algernon. My brothers are Alfred, he's the oldest currently, and Albert. Pleased to meet you. Likewise. This is you. We arrived at the top of the stairs and directly opposite a door, painted a muddy blue colour. The door was ajar. Inside, a small room painted to resemble the ocean. Waves crashed at head height, seagulls argued on the ceiling. Below the water, porpoises frolicked, and the floor was painted yellow, like sand, with crabs and shells. The bed resembled a giant clam. Well, I'd say nice, but... Look, I don't want to be rude, but it's a bit weird, isn't it? Weird. He looked at me in that expressionless way the owls have, the way I was beginning to find a little creepy. Yeah, all the sea stuff. That's for the job. Yeah, about that, I'm not clear on what's going on. You go to sleep. And? And nothing, that's your job. You go to sleep. Oh, okay. What's all that stuff about dreams being petrol, my brain being a car? Don't worry about it. Okay. Off you go. What? He held the door open whilst trying to direct me inside, like a traffic policeman directing cars to pass. All you want me to do is get to sleep. That's right. Okay. I walked over the threshold and over to the bed with its seaweed-coloured sheets. Salt dreams, Algernon said, closing the door. I sat on the bed and looked around the room. I got up, paced around the room, peered under the bed, went back and sat back on the bed. Well, this was odd. It appeared that I'd been brought out of school to a strange house to go to sleep. I could hear mumbling downstairs before music started up. I'm not exactly sure what sea shanties are, but I strongly suspected they were playing them downstairs. Now, Mr. Garner and Mr. Humphreys both seemed to be in on this, and they wouldn't wish me harm. They'd be hell to pay with my parents, for a start. I looked at the provided pyjamas, black silky leggings, and a black and white striped top. Okay, maybe the best way to find out what's going on is to just go with it, just play along. I got changed and got into bed. Under the pillow, I found several books, including 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Moby Dick. I flicked through Moby Dick for a bit, but the words were quite difficult, so I put it back and lay down. I expected I'd have a problem going to sleep, but head, pillow, light. Maybe there was something in the tea. I wondered why it tasted like oranges. The seagull's cries sounded like drunken sailors laughing. The sun whips my back, and the salt sting of the ocean is in my eyes. The boat pitches in yours, its timbers creaking. The sailors hum a sea shanty, or a close approximation of such, or what I assume to be such. Captain stands in front of me. Mr. Bentley? With an E, sir. Ah, yes, of course. Mr. Bentley, what do you think you're doing? Well, I think I'm swabbing the deck. Swabbing, is it? Yes, although I'm not sure what swabbing involves. I can see that. It's the brig for you, Bentley. He stops roaring for a moment, leans in close. You do know what a brig is, don't you? I think so. He stands back at his full height and recommences roaring. Good, then it's a brig for you, along with the other troublemakers. Two sailors appear, one on each side of me, and carry me over to a hole in the deck, which they then throw me down. It's gloomy and cooler in the brig, which I imagine poorly, to be honest, but well enough for there to be a bit of a table in it, around which are Mrs. Fassett and the owls. Yes, well, didn't I tell you I had a rare gift, gentlemen? Mrs. Fassett arched an eyebrow as I sat close by. Well done, Bentley. Now make sure to stay asleep so we can get this job done. Mrs. Fassett takes out her massive pocket watch and checks the time before she turns it over and presses a button, and another part pops open, a hidden compass. Gosh, that's rather clever, I say. Fassett glances up, but dismisses my outburst. Got him. She pulls out a proper, old-fashioned, cloth-like parchment and unfurls it. On it is a map like none I've ever seen before. It's a patchwork of book covers in a myriad of shapes, colours and sizes with fonts of all types. Cool, I say. She takes out what looks like a protractor and makes a few measurements on the map, and makes marks in a small blue notebook she opens in her lap. She reels off a string of numbers and letters that make no sense to me, but the three owls start drawing a chalk outline on the hull. It's a crude chalk door. When they open it, I'm taken aback, as not only does it open into a tropical island, but the sea doesn't come rushing in. Gentlemen, Mrs. Fassett says. Albert says, after you. As Alfred, who mimics his brother in justice for Algernon, to go through first. And Algernon looks at me. How about Bentley goes first? And before I know it, they're ushering me through the door. As I go through, I drop about a foot, which I'm not expecting. So I'm picking myself up off the disc like soft white sand when a pirate, who hadn't spotted until this moment, points his sword at me. His stick-like arms poke out of ratty clothes that have seen better days. His sword, though, looks the business. I clamber up and see over the pirate's shoulder a hole in the air, the other side of which has Facet and Co. jumping through as quietly as they can. Mrs. Facet pulls out a large gun and points it at the pirate. Albert struggles under the weights of a large Gladstone bag, and Algernon, the last through, pulls the door closed behind him, and the air appears to be continuous, no trace of a hole ever existing. Put the sword down, please, Mr. Silver. Silver looks from me to the owls and Facet, and lets the sword drop to the sand, where it bites and stands for a second, before toppling and flicking sand up. He puts his hand on his hips and says, "Well, this is a pickle to be sure." He hops from one bare foot to the other. That sand must be hot. Will it be, boys? Be we friends or be we enemies? Facet sighs, consults her pocket watch that silver nakedly covers. She sighs again. Mr. Silver, in approximately 10 years, you have to appear in a best-selling novel, and you have to have one leg. Silver, who's staring at the watch, looks up sharply. What? I echo him. What? I'm ignored by all parties. I decide to wait and see what happens. After all, this is my dream. I'm afraid, Mr. Silver, that we're here to take your leg. Wait, can you go over that bit again? Which bit? Something novel, something leg. So all of it? Yes. In 10 of your years, you will be a major character in a book called Treasure Island, in which you menace a small boy whilst hopping around on crutches on account of you only having one leg. Clearly, you can only have two legs. We're here for one of them. You want me leg? The poor man seems bewildered. I sympathise. Grab him. Silver turns and makes him run for it. Facet shoots in the air. Stop, or I'll shoot. In the leg. Deciding that's a trick he's willing to take, or perhaps he just hadn't heard, Silver keeps running and appears to be well practised at it. Facet stands edge onto him, draws a bead, closes one eye and cocks her head. So she's looking down the barrel and takes a second shot, which misses. Damn. She takes a large breath, holds it in, and slowly exhales, squeezing the trigger. The gun bucks. There is a puff of smoke, and in the distance, Silver stumbles and falls. Bring the bag, Facet says. And we troop down the beach to where Silver lies clutching his leg. Nasty wound you've got there. Luckily, I have my medical equipment. Boys, looks like we have to perform an amputation. No, please, not the leg, not the leg. Silver attempts to fight them, and as they wrestle, I say, this can't be right. However, Alfred appears to be fairly dexterous with a syringe, and soon has Silver unconscious. Hey, I shout, as Mrs. Facet says, prepare him. Yes? The owls are cutting away one leg of the trousers and painting his leg with something red, maybe iodine. What are you doing? You can't just cut somebody's leg off. You've read Treasure Island? Yes. He's Long John Silver. What? How? He must have one leg in 10 years' time, when Stevenson imagines him for the first time. What? How? No, I was right the first time. What? Look, I don't have time to explain. Okay, look, if you don't explain, I'm going to wake up. One. Two. Oh, wait. Okay, explain. Okay, I'll explain. No, it'll take too long. I'll summarise. Biblionauts. Here she points at herself and the owls, who all appear to now be wearing butcher aprons and are looking at me in that blank way that they have. Yes, I say. I'm not quite sure what a biblionaut is, but assume it's something to do with travelling in books. The world of dreams, myths, legends and ideas, she says, doing a sweeping motion all around, taking in the beach, the sea and the whole island beyond. Dreamer, she says, pointing at me. Door, she says, still pointing at me. Writers get their ideas from the place of myths and legends. Here, it is non-contiguous and atemporal. I frown. It's in many places and many times, she says. I make an ah noise. It's leaky, you see. Now, every time a book has to be reprinted, it has to be rewritten again. This is a big secret. Borgia nearly gave it away, but a colleague spotted it in time and fixed it. Sometimes, there are disturbances in the debris. Things are copied down incorrectly. Or one of the copyists gets ideas about their station and makes changes. I'm confused again. Just go with it, she whispers. And those disturbances can lead to a story going Well, wrong. The inspiration juice ceases to flow, and a book can die if the author doesn't get the right inspiration at the right time. Biblion ought to spot this and take action. Like now. She points at Silver. Wait, an author gets inspiration for this place? Yes. Then writes a book that makes changes in this place? Yes. Then somebody copies that book down wrong? Yes. That poisons the inspiration that allowed the book to be written in the first place? You've got it. That doesn't make any sense. Whoever said dreams and stories had to make sense? Well, they do have an underlying truth. I don't understand. Look, this has to happen. Now be a good fellow and go down the beach a ways and keep a lookout. I walk off. Well, I don't think I could stop them. It makes a certain kind of dream logic, I suppose. When they're finished, they walk up to me. They've cleaned themselves off. Okay, Bentley. Time for another dream. Another? Yes, you have four more in you, remember? Now what do you know about Captain Ahab?
Oh, thank you, Pete. I think a little bit of light relief was just what we needed after all that death and destruction that David treated us to. We'll take another break now, let people replenish their glasses, and then we'll come back and have a quick Q&A.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.